Hey, whoa. Okay, that was a first round pick, all right? That was a real, honest to God, collar popping first round pick, okay?
Yeah.
I was DMing Max yesterday, Rappaport, and I was just like, now I get it. Like, now you're right. He's an idiot. He's a buffoon.
Yeah.
I thought everyone was just being too hard on him, but like, no, he's actually an idiot.
Right. It is worrying, man. I gotta say, the Philly people are kind of funny. Like, they're really good bloggers. They're like elite level bloggers, you know, but it is funny how much the process had become this thing. And how much like the Colangelos have become this anti thing. So it is kind of a funny balance and situation that they're in.
Like I think on a base level, I agree with them with the idea that like Hinkie shouldn't have been fired and Colangelo is a worse situation. But I think that, you know, they drum it up because it's fun, you know?
Like, oh, for sure. You said it perfectly. That's exactly it. They are right, but they're so ridiculous about it that it's almost comical.
Okay, but that's what I was telling Max yesterday, though. That's the thing, is like, this, I think that the New Orleans move was actually as bad as people responded to it, because,
oh yeah, for sure,
everyone's like, oh, he's deceiving, but it's like, okay, you know what, like, it's injuries, like, it's not a big deal. But their press release, the Sixers press release, opened with Nerlens Noel traded for first round pick Justin Anderson and Andrew Bogut. Like, it opened with first round pick. And I think that was actually embarrassing and deceitful. And I think that he was actually caught with his pants down in a way that saying like, oh, he has a micro MCL tear isn't like being caught with your pants down. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And then let's see some of the other moves, signing like Gerald Henderson and stuff like that. It's just like, you know, yeah, it wasn't quite as good as Boogie, but we're still talking about a league average GM. But over the last week or so, I feel like I can't make that argument anymore, because the Jahlil thing was embarrassing.
We should talk about this on the pod, though, because
I've already started recording, so it's good.
Oh, so we're... I did it. I was so stealth.
I probably should have said something. I wasn't even like trying to be sneaky. I just actually just hit record.
And I like podcasts just start naturally. I think it's better than the whole like formal beginning. So good job, and bad job for me for ruining it. But well, I do want to say one thing.
Like, now you can say, like, you know, my guest today is Adam Juarez. Like, we should have done this earlier, maybe. Adam, introduce yourself. Talk about what you're doing. Oh, I heard you on Colorado Sports Guy recently. Or no, I just heard Matt Moore talking about you on Colorado Sports Guy. That's what it was.
So I run DenverStiffs.com, which is the Denver Nuggets blog for SB Nation. Been around for a decade. I've been running it for 2 years. I also write for Vice. I do a weekly column where I break down a team. This week I broke down the Pelicans. So I always take like one angle and kind of run with it for that Friday column. I really like writing that Friday column, by the way. And then I do the Locked On Nuggets podcast.
Most of the time I break down stuff sort of like what you do, where I'll talk about one team at a time or one thing at a time. Today we're talking about the trade deadline, and it's a little bit more general than most of my podcasts. But we were just talking about the Sixers. Do you want to wrap that up? I mean, so I just said the Jahlil thing was embarrassing, and the Nerlens Noel, like, that was a really bad return.
So here's my thought on it. You know how there's coaches where you're like, oh, he's a really good coach for a young team, but at some point you have to find the coach that's good for an experienced team, right? Like, there's Scott Brooks is kind of the example in OKC. I think a lot of, right or wrong, a lot of people thought he was good to get them to a point. Now you got to find the other guy. And maybe Phil Jackson is the good example of the other one, where he's probably not going to take a group of young guys and turn them into a good team, but maybe he can like get a bunch of egos and turn them into a great team. So I think the same is sort of true for the NBA GMs. And I don't know, we'll never know with Hinkie. I have no idea, but I do know that he made some moves that either worked out better than he ever could have possibly imagined. But even if they worked out just like 70%, as you know, like if he thought they were going to work out 70% this well, he's still a genius, because he just set them up to make it so difficult for them to not succeed.
Right, yeah.
And so But who knows if he would have been a guy that could recruit free agents and could have done all these other types of deals. I don't know. We'll never get to find that out. My hunch is probably no, because for all of his strengths, I'm a huge Hinkie supporter and stan. Like, I love Hinkie. But I do think that there would have been some obstacles for him and some areas he would have had to really have grown. And we'll never know that. But on the other side, we now have the Colangelos, who have done some good things in the past. They've done some really bad things in the past, but they've had some successes in the past. And I think maybe the idea that their reputation around the league is stronger and that'll help them to, you know, maybe in the next phase. But we're seeing right now that I don't know if they know how to manage the assets the way that Sam Hinkie did.
I'm not sure they're as glorious and high reputation I'm not sure that even matters, I guess, at this stage.
Well, that's the big point, right? Is that they're not at the stage anyway. They're still in the Hinkie stage. They still very much should be playing the long game and collecting assets and managing them well. And that last move to me was such a step backwards for them. I mean, it's not going to kill them. Still, their hopes still hinge on Simmons and Embiid and these draft picks coming. But it's just still. It still diminishes what they had going just a little bit, in my opinion.
Okay, here's what I think, and this isn't just because I'm from Dallas. Like, I was sort of saying or drawing this comparison before he ended up in Dallas, and now that Nerlens is in Dallas, I'm excited about that because that's my team and it's great. I was approaching Nerlens as I was drawing the comparison of whoever picks up Nerlens is going to be like the Rockets when they picked up James Harden. Not quite as significant, but I think Nerlens is really, really good in a place on a team where at least at his position, there was a lot of other like really high, great young prospects. And I think Nerlens is going to end up being a like top 10 probably at his position center. And then his ceiling, I think we can probably both agree that his ceiling is massive. And I mean, it would be great if he reaches that ceiling, but not everyone does. So from that perspective, the fact that, I mean, Justin Anderson was benched for, I don't even remember his name. I think he was like an NBA 2K creative player. And then Bogut, who like has barely played and is averaging 4 points a game in his minutes and like 2 second round picks. Like that's really poor return for a player who we could be looking at as like a all defensive guy.
There's cost and there's opportunity cost, and the cost for Nerlens Noel in this deal was like so ridiculously cheap. Nerlens Noel is so much better than what Dallas gave up, and he could be a great fit there. The opportunity cost I also think is bad. Like, I still think Philadelphia screwed that up, but at least it's a little bit closer. And it brings me to another interesting point is that the NBA is so top heavy and bottom heavy, right? And it has been for the last, I mean, it's always been this way, but it's especially been this way over the last decade, where I think GMs have become a little bit smarter about how draft picks matter so much. And if you're not, nobody wants to be in the middle, so you race to the top or you race to the bottom. And one of the problems with that is that picks and prospects do start to cannibalize each other. And this happened, and you see a lot of the deals that happened here at this deadline. That was sort of the case. For Philadelphia, obviously they have Embiid, they've got Okafor, and they had Noel, and somebody was going to miss out. So they had this situation where everybody in the NBA knew that they had to make a deal, and that lowers the value of the players they're trying to deal. The same thing happened in Denver. They had Nikola Jokic and they have Yusuf Nurkic. Yusuf Nurkic is a starting center in the NBA. He's not better than Nikola Jokic. So now and everybody in the NBA knows that. Then you throw in some off-court troubles, both with Noel, you know, injuries and off-court stuff, and with Nurkic, injuries and off-court stuff. And I think every team now looks at those two teams and says, here's an opportunity we can get really great value, really great return on. And so it is interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how teams handle this going forward. The Nuggets, to bring them back up, they've got Emmanuel Mudiay and Jamal Murray, and also, by the way, Jameer Nelson. So now you have one of those guys is not going to play, and for a long time it's been Jamal Murray. Now the Nuggets have kind of switched that, and it's one of those unforeseen, or maybe it was foreseen, but it's one of those under-the-radar issues with being all in on a rebuild, is that unless you just have five prospects that all play different positions, you're going to end up cannibalizing some of your prospects and not getting enough minutes. And I think that's sort of one of the themes of this trade deadline.
So the problem here for me with Philly, and we'll get to the Nuggets thing, and I understand the connection, and I agree with you on a fundamental level, but it's the tripartite aspect of the Philly thing that makes it bad. Insofar as the move here, I think that the better move, I would have given a higher grade to the Sixers if they had just literally waived Jahlil. Because like, right? Because like Joel Embiid, we don't know what's going on with Joel Embiid, and everyone hopes that he's going to be a super duper star, and like no one more than me. Actually, there are plenty of people more than me, but like I really want it to, you know. But in all likelihood, he is going to miss an average of 25-30 games every season for the rest of his career, which may be a little bit shorter. And having a really really good backup center, I think, is worth paying for, and Jahlil is not it.
Especially if that guy can play power forward, which I don't know if Nerlens Noel can. They didn't really give him enough minutes.
Why don't we know, though? We should know that.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but we know Okafor can't, right? Like, he can't even guard five, so like he definitely can't guard fours.
Are you saying he's a point guard?
Yeah, right. So that was just mismanaged. I'm not trying to defend Philly and say, oh, their hands were tied, they did what they could.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just saying that there is this element to it that kind of influences it. And on top of that, they screwed it up. So I'm with you on that. And honestly, it's funny because Sam Hinkie is such a not basketball guy, right? Like, he is a basketball. I'm not saying he's not a basketball mind. But the way he set the process itself wasn't necessarily a basketball process. It was just like a reason and like a logic.
Preparing for optionalities.
Exactly. And so you draft three centers, and it's like, what are you doing? But I think Hinkie knew, like, there's a timing that's very important with this. Like, yes, it's stupid to have three centers, but if they all have value and you manage it correctly, then you can get back return. And I think he wasn't that far off on that. But the timing that the Colangelos have used have been pretty silly. And not only the Colangelos, but also you look at the coaching staff, because they did need to figure out what worked together and what didn't. And 8 minutes for Noel and Embiid was a waste, and it ended up making that trio a waste, in my opinion.
He probably gets a little bit of a pass because the idea is to get a superstar, but you're by definition not optimizing everything. So you end up with three centers, but you think that each of those three centers, and arguably he was right at the time. I think that when he picked Nerlens, he had the highest upside in the draft. And when he picked Embiid, he clearly did. And when he picked Jahlil, that's the question mark there.
That's the question. That's not even a question mark. To me, that one is just a mistake. But again, the one thing I think people on the outside don't realize, and myself included, sometimes we don't think about this, is we don't know what was happening behind the scenes, because obviously there was the rumors about Kristaps isn't going to go there. He won't play there. We don't know how much of that is like, I think people on the outside are like, you draft him and you force him to play, call his bluff. But maybe there was more to it and you just never know. So maybe his hands were tied. But nonetheless, the timing is more important, because I think you can draft three centers, but you have to know that the window of opportunity to sell on those picks is really, really, really small. And you have to manage things right. And I do want to bring it back to Denver for this reason. Last year, the Nuggets were never going to make the playoffs. They never were really in the conversation. They were always like five games behind.
Yeah, let's transition into Denver. So, cool. Yeah, start us off.
And so they never played Nurkic and Jokic together until like the last eight games. I want to say they played like less than 100 minutes last year. And to me, that was really stupid, because, again, you have to look at the window of opportunity. Yeah, it's tough to give up on making the playoffs, but you have to be realistic. You're five games behind in January and you have a young team anyway. Are you really realistic about making the playoff push? And then on top of that, are you really risking something if you play those two guys together a little bit? They didn't end up doing that last year. They did end up doing it this year, and it might cost them the playoffs now this year, because for a month and a half, they didn't know what they had. They had to figure it out, where they could have done that last year and had a much better read on it. So the timing of a rebuild is so difficult, and it's easy to say these things in hindsight. It's much harder in real time. But I think in both Philly's case and Denver's case, Philly, it was a small misstep. With Denver, I think it was a big one in not figuring out what they had with Jokic and Nurkic and moving earlier before Nurkic completely fell off the face of the earth in Denver.
Well, I think at least with Denver, you have this component of it where to really know that the Nurkic thing isn't going to work out. You have to do some like sports psychology from the front, from the, because like if Nurkic had remained playing at the level that everyone got so excited about him, then it would have been fine. He would have come off the bench and done that for 20 or 22 minutes. But asking management to be able to psychoanalyze Nurkic and know that he's not going to be happy coming off the bench is a little bit more difficult than just saying, come on, Colangelo, get the two best of the three assets. I just don't think that in the Nuggets case, it's necessarily fair to pin it on management. Well, you should have expected Nurkic to throw a tantrum because he's a 22-year-old man, you know, like 23, 24.
The difference is I think people close to the organization saw this a while back. And yeah, I think you hope, okay, there's some cultural differences, there's some age and maturity things, but I think the writing was on the wall so long ago. There's a reason Michael Malone flew to Bosnia over the summer.
Yeah, and like, I was about to mention that.
Yeah, went like all of out of his way to try to like connect with him. And the reason was because there was a disconnect. So I think these things, it was not like they snuck up on him. But again, I'm not trying to criticize Nuggets management or coaching staff. I'm simply trying to show what the challenge was and grading how they handled that challenge in hindsight. So in hindsight, I think they waited too long. They ended up you look at it. Is Nurkic better than Plumlee? I think he might be. And the Nuggets threw a first round pick on top of that when they traded him. And I don't think that was the case if they would have done this, you know, over the summer or maybe even earlier in the season. I don't think they would have had to have made such a desperate deal. So I don't know. I'm just trying to point out the difficulty they ran into down the stretch when they didn't, you know, kind of nip it in the bud and figure out what they had earlier.
Well, I just think, you know, the question becomes at this point, would you have been better off sort of just literally waving Nurkic? Like, because I just feel like, you know, the even if Plumlee is as good as the Nuggets hope that he is, and I think that's probably not true. I think that he's probably just a tiny bit worse than they think he is, and that's okay. That's like the reality of like trading a player. I still do think that a first round pick is more flexible, even if you have 50 of them, because eventually you're going to need to, you know, like get a safety pin, get like three first round picks, and like attach them to Fareed and go get like LaMarcus Aldridge or something like that.
The unspoken thing here is that mid-market teams and small-market teams like Denver, they just have to make desperate moves. I mean, no matter what, they could win 55 games next year, and in free agency, they're still going to have to overpay people just because that's the nature of being the Denver Nuggets. Now, somebody threw this out to me, and I actually kind of agree with it. Could they have traded Nurkic to Dallas for Andrew Bogut, who, you know, the whole thing with Plumlee is, yeah, he's great now. He's going to be great, but this summer it makes a very interesting how much do you pay, you don't want to overpay thing. With Bogut, you wouldn't have had that. It's just like, we got him for now. He plays defense and he passes. We can play just like we play with Nikola Jokic off the bench. He's not going to care about only playing 18 minutes a game. And then we don't have, you know, we can go after Plumlee in the summer. I think that makes sense. And then on top of that, you kept your pick. And I think that makes sense because you get 90%, maybe you get 100% of what you get with Plumlee. And
you might be able to get a couple of picks from Dallas. I mean, probably like the two second rounders that we're going to end up sending to Philly. But it's like I think it's not a big deal, and we'll see whether that's true.
I'm with you. We're fighting over like the margins here. This isn't the big stuff that derails or makes a franchise. These are more the little things that.
Well, I think for Philly, it's a big deal. That's why I mentioned the James Harden thing. I think it's a big deal that they just gave up Nerlens when they could have just given up on Jahlil, who I think is going to be in the league for a long time, but not because he's good, you know, but because he was a second round, like, or he was the second pick in the draft. I think it could end up being the case that it's a disaster that they didn't hold on to Nerlens, right? Like, that's actually a uncomfortably high likelihood given Joel Embiid's health status.
It was definitely the wrong move, but here's where I'll disagree with you, is that they've got potentially two top four picks coming. They've got another top pick the following year. They've got Embiid and Simmons. Like, there's still a chance. The reason you're right that it was they missed out on the opportunity cost, but there's a chance they're still going to have Fultz, Josh Jackson, Simmons, Embiid, and another pick coming the next year, and all these tradable players like Saric if they want to trade him, and you know, Okafor or whatever coming to. So they've got all these options still on the table that, to me, I'm just like, yeah, they screwed up. They've got to screw up like three more times to really blow this.
But
it's that's how great Hinkies has set him up, that a mistake like this, as big as it is,
that was
have like four more mistakes in them before it's ruined.
That was like really ominous from my perspective. Like, that was like famous last words. They still need to mess this up like three or four more times. Like, really, like, who would do that?
Oh my
boy. Okay. Well, so, is there anything more you want to say about the Nuggets? We've covered Philly. I think I want to go Rockets next, unless you have more to say about the Nuggets. It's your team, so.
Yeah, let me just say that this Emmanuel Mudiay thing is very interesting. I think from the outside looking in, the idea is, well, Mudiay just was a bust, and now he's done. In my perspective, he's played terribly, and he's been given enough minutes that you think he should prove it. But look, Nurkic is going to be a good player now in Portland. Mudiay, if he's not going to play, the Nuggets are going to trade him this summer. He's only 20. There's a great chance he's going to go to a team that he really starts to hit his stride with. And as a Nuggets fan, I'm more concerned now with this idea of, we had all these young prospects, and now we're at the point where we have to start cutting them because a couple of them are so bad. And I think it's going to come back to haunt the Nuggets. Not haunt them in like, you made a bad trade, but just haunt them as in like, why didn't these guys play well in Denver? And I don't actually have the answer for that, but I'm afraid that the Nuggets are heading that direction.
Yeah. Best case scenario, you can say, well, it's a Reggie Jackson, Russell Westbrook situation where we just had really two really good options that could not get along, and we took the better of the two. And I think that Westbrook Reggie Jackson comparison is probably getting really close. Like, what,
right?
Yep. One of them's not happy, you got the better of the two, and although Reggie Jackson went out and got a max contract, and Nurkic is probably going to be a really good player, there's no question who's better, Reggie or Russell, and there's no question who's better, Jokic or Nurkic, and there probably won't be for the rest of their careers.
I haven't thought about that comp. The reason I love that is Reggie Jackson left Oklahoma City and had some high moments like early on after that. Now we kind of see he's like back to, he's almost poison. It seems like they wanted to trade him so badly.
What are you trying to say about Nurkic right now?
I have been so hard on Nurkic that I have been taking some heat lately about like overdoing my criticisms of him as a player. But let's just say my prediction is, and I said this as soon as the trade happened, I think he's going to have a solid end of the year this year. I think he's going to have a great start of the season next year, and probably somewhere around January of the following year, he's going to tail off. And that's just from the experience of watching him for the last 3 years. So that's my prediction, and that mirrors the Reggie Jackson situation pretty well.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty solid comparison. I just thought of it, so I feel good about that.
That's great.
So, all right, I think that we can start to touch on, and I guess this works because, in addition to being the editor of Denver Stiffs and a columnist at Vice, you're also the host of Locked On Nuggets, and the head of the whole Locked On network is David Locke, who has this stat, which is pack. I'm not sure if you've heard about that or like looked into it a little bit.
Don't tell my boss, but I do not. I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, okay. Well, so it's points above average created, and basically the concept, and I run a basketball network that competes directly with David, but you know, whatever, listeners, like, it's great. His network is great. Listen to my podcast first, and then you can listen to his. But pack, it's points above average created, and the idea is, if you have 50 possessions, how many points are you getting with that over how many points is someone like a different average NBA player going to get? Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah.
So like, the more possessions you use, the more chances you have to like increase that number, but you have to be efficient too, right?
Right.
Lou Williams has like a 3 or 4 pack, which is a top 20 in the league level, right? And it's supposed to be a catch-all for offense. Like, how good is this offensive player? Using efficiency as the number one thing, but also taking into account volume. And so he's number like 20 or 15 in the league, and now he's going to the Rockets. So What are your thoughts on that? Because I think that if anyone's going to actually supercharge the most supercharged offense in the league, it's probably going to be Lou Will.
Well, my first thought is just hearing the stat from you and not having too much familiarity with it. I would think that it the stat skews in favor of finishers, meaning guys that finish the play, right? Because it might take you 50 games to get 50 scoring, you know, opportunities or just playmaking assists, whatever. But those plays are a lot easier when you're the finisher. And Lou Williams is kind of he creates as well, but he's kind of a guard finisher in that he's like a great catch and shoot shooter. And he finishes the play on a kick out. So I don't know that I would call him, and I don't think you're saying this, but I wouldn't call him like a top 25 player. But that being said, the guy is such a great fit in Houston. Like, Houston has all the shooters. There's a reason that they have all of this crazy offense and shoot so many threes, and D'Antoni wants them to shoot 50 a game now, I think he said. And the reason is threefold. One, they have a bunch of great shooters. Two, they have James Harden. And three, they have Mike D'Antoni. Like, they're just running this perfect system to kind of exploit that. And honestly, I think James Harden is probably the second best guy to run – maybe the first best guy to run the system, to be honest with you, behind LeBron. LeBron's, like, also great at this spread – pick and roll style offense. But I think he's going to be a great fit there, and he just makes them so interesting. They were already one of the most interesting teams of the last 10 years, but now they're so fascinating, because can they score 130 points on like the Warriors, a great defense, or the Spurs? I think they might be able to. And it actually even leads to, and I don't want to transition too soon if you want to stick on that, but it also leads me to another thought of, why is scoring up so much, and is it because teams have actually perfected this offense, and maybe there's not a counter for the defense, or maybe there's just not a we just haven't thought of it yet, or a team hasn't figured it out yet. But it definitely seems like the NBA has figured out the offensive part of this new era, and the defense is lagging behind.
I think we've okay.
We can get to that later if you want, but I think it's an interesting concept.
I think that if we leave that idea, we won't find our way back, but we'll find our way back to Lou Will, because it's like what we were supposed to talk about in the first place.
Okay. All right.
So what I think it is that you can only be so good at defense, and the athletic and skill level of being a great defender has sort of already been met. Like, the fact that Tony Allen is like a generational defender, like you know, that sort of means something, because Tony Allen is not like the best, you know, player ever. But meanwhile, like on the other hand, it's like you have Giannis, who can play a forward position, and just because his arms are so incredibly long and because his skill level is so ridiculously high, you can have guys like that at every position, but you can only have Rudy Gobert at one.
Yeah. But you know what? The future of the NBA might be more Giannis's. And I know it's crazy. Everybody said, well, there's only one Giannis. And they're right. There is only one right now. But I wonder if more and more, like Willie Cauley-Stein growing up now, is he trying to become a big, or is he trying to become Giannis? And is the NBA looking at prospects when they're 18 years old and thinking, hey, can this Willie Cauley-Stein guy be molded into a Giannis? Like, is that what we can kind of look at him for or try to train him? I'm talking about defensively, by the way, not offensively, because that's a lot more innate talent. But just I wonder that, because we're already looking at this revolution of bigs playing small ball, like Jokic playing outside, Porzingis playing outside, all this stuff. But so we know that the NBA can kind of evolve relatively quickly, and I wonder if the NBA will evolve in that regard quickly, where we're starting to say, what's the most valuable player we need? A 6'11 defender that can guard point guards. And I don't know, but maybe that is the next evolution, and these things kind of go in waves, and we're on the offensive wave right now.
Well, I think... maybe. I don't know. And isn't part of it, too, like the change in hand-checking rules and the way that the game's sort of refereed now?
Of course. But again, because I this is my favorite topic, by the way. But yes, it's these things all are chain reaction things, right? Like the defensive 3 seconds and hand-checking thing led to different styles of defense. I think that was the first evolution, by the way. It was this kind of like Tibbs-style overloading the defense on one side. And then you obviously had 7 seconds or less as well, but I think 7 seconds or less in a weird way was like slower to adapt. But then you had the spread offense style that adapted to Tibbs' defense of like, you know, ball movement, but also spreading the ball around the perimeter. And then you had small ball, And then you have big ball playing small ball, big guys playing small ball.
Skill ball.
Yeah, skill ball. So giant skill ball. So now.
Oh, God. Pelicans.
Yeah. And that's why the Pelicans are an interesting one, but there's more to that. But yeah, so these things do kind of go one after the other. And that's why I think like the next shift might happen next year, might happen 2-3 years from now. But we're definitely in this era where the offense has figured out how to beat the latest defense. And the defense hasn't figured it out yet.
I think the reason why why is offense getting better faster than the defense, than NBA defenses in general, I think it's probably most interesting because what you're doing really is not finding the reason, but finding out all of the different reasons and assigning percentages to them.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? Like it's like, well, it's 20% because there's no hand checking and 15% because there's these ridiculous NBA players like Steph Curry, who we'd never seen before. And then it's 50% because Tom Thibodeau doesn't coach every team. And, you know, you just sort of like go down the list and it's like,
But even Thibodeau, like this is my hottest take of all. But like, is Tibbs going to be like, what is his next move? Is his system and his defense going to be able to dominate the NBA the way it did in 2009? I don't know. My guess is that offensives have at least to a degree figured that out. And not only have offenses figured that out, but like you said, the players that are coming into the league now are designed to sort of beat that, like. I mean, his defense, part of what his defense did was it killed isolations, right? If you isolate Kobe Bryant on the elbow and you throw three defenders on the strong side, then he has to not only beat his man, not only beat the rim protector, but he also has to beat a third guy that's coming over to like beat him. So I just wonder, like, what's his next move? Because I'm not convinced just doing what he did for the Bulls is going to be successful, you know, going forward, or the Celtics and Bulls, it'll be successful going forward.
Oh, no, I definitely agree. I think we're actually a few evolutions down the line. I think that Tibbs' defense turned into Vogel's, where Vogel's was like the same, basically strong side, weak side, not zone, but sort of zone, right. Man-to-man zone, right? And then basically Vogel just added Paul George and said, you have a little bit more creative liberty if we need you to play free safety. Right. And then I think
so much length on those Indiana teams. Like they were, Paul George is such a unique example. Cause what is he? 6'10", 6'11"?
Right. Right. Yeah, no, exactly. So I think that like that was enough of an alteration and enough of a step up from what, like I think Paul George's role in the Indiana defense was a step up from what Luol Deng's role was in that Bulls defense. And
right.
Then the step after that, where I think that right now this is the pinnacle of NBA defense conceptually and actually statistically too, is doing that and having the Paul George guy on both sides of the basketball court and the half court, which is what Greg Popovich is doing with Danny Green and Kawhi Leonard. It's like they play strong side, weak side. And what I've been calling it is like, instead of playing on a string, it's tug of war, where you just sort of like move, shift back and forth as your two wings, where if the ball's on Kawhi's side of the court, on the court that happens to be where Kawhi's covering the guy who has the ball in his hands, then Danny Green is sort of like naturally moving, starting to move towards like, say, the free throw line, or not like the free throw line, but you know, he's starting to inch towards the center of the court so that he can get involved in the play if he has to. And then the same thing happens the other way around when Kawhi's man doesn't have the ball in his hand and Danny Green is covering the guard who's initiating offense. So I think that Greg Popovich right now is playing defense the best way that I've been able to like think about, you know, because what's so great about that system of sort of having these two elite defenders who really get their hand in, like one or the other is going to be involved in every defensive play that the other team has. Like there's just like no way that's not going to happen. And what that means is like essentially the two of them in tandem are a rim protector. So you can replace Tim Duncan with Pau Gasol and still have the best defense in the league.
They're so athletic because what you're describing is sort of what Miami did in their day with Wade and LeBron, because they could cover so much ground and they were like able to kind of fly around like that. Now you add that with like length and more teams having this length. And I think you're right. That might be the next evolution of it. It's just these guys that are able to kind of cover that much ground.
Tug of war. It's like playing on a string, but it's back.
On top of having, yeah, the scheme that allows for it. So it's interesting to think. I always wonder this. How much are teams spending their like their summers thinking about these problems, and how much of it is just like more of a basic like meaning how much are teams going to the drawing board and really thinking outside of the box and thinking abstractly about these problems in the summers? Because I'd be very curious. I imagine some teams are, but I wonder how much all teams are really thinking about what's the next paradigm shift.
Why would they need to when bloggers go out and do their work for them?
That was such a blogger comment, by the way. That was like a blogger comment.
One of us are going to, we're just going to write something and they're just going to see it. And I think that's what they do. I think they really care about what bloggers have to say. That's my impression.
They spend hours reading us for
that could be a transition into the Pelicans, because Boogie I think actually does spend hours reading about what's written about him. How I think that that's a really interesting move.
Fascinating.
You should start this out, because I'm not even quite sure where I want to start, because
I wrote two articles on the Pelicans this week. One on NBA.com, so I'm kind of excited. That was like my first ever on NBA, on the stats page of NBA.com. There's a new partnership with Nylon Calculus and NBA. So that was really, really cool. And it was really a stats-based one. And then I did one on Vice where I talked about five types of actions that now the Pelicans can do that are unique and effective. And when I was researching this and like watching a bunch of film, I really don't – first of all, I'm not a huge DeMarcus Cousins fan. I'm a huge fan of his skill set.
Exactly.
I'm not a huge fan of how he deploys that. Like he I think the phrase I came up with was that he's capable of doing things on the court that nobody else can do, and he's also capable of doing things that nobody else should do. And so, like, and he kind of mixes those in a way that's just like just not good enough to be, you know, for my taste. But the other thing is he's kind of like Carmelo in that his favorite and most comfortable thing, like his comfort zone, is not his best skills. Like his comfort zone is like 8 dribble post ups or 8 dribble drive moves. And those are great as like the flavor, like the frills around his actual best skill sets, but he uses them as if they're the main course. And so when you play now with a player like Anthony Davis, who's one of the best finishers in the NBA, not finishers as in like just dunkers, but finishers as in you kick out to him, he could shoot it. You drive and dish, he could finish it. He can rebound, he can pick and roll, all those types of finishes. So you start playing with a guy like that, and it's even more important now for Cousins to tap into the good parts of his game. And on paper, yeah, it works. But in theory, how much can Cousins play the way that he needs to in order to win? And that's where I kind of draw the line. I'm just not sure, and I'm actually not even optimistic.
Well, okay, well, I guess we don't need to have a conversation because you just said all of my thoughts. So,
let me say this because it's so interesting. Here's the part that makes it so Boogie is like so tantalizing, right? Like you really want to buy it.
If he optimized his skill set, he would probably be the best player in the league statistically. Although LeBron would still be the best player in the league, but if DeMarcus like did all the things that he dominates at instead of just doing the things that he's really good at, he would be dominant instead of just really good.
Oh, like incredible. And he's like, he is dominant on an individual level. It just never seems to translate to success. And that's why I think it's funny. The whole like, I need help thing is kind of funny. It's always funny to me because great players like turn other guys in. LeBron turned Mo Williams into an all-star, right? Like, LeBron needed help when his first time in Cleveland and didn't get it, but at least it was disguised because he made those guys look good. So, you know what I mean? Like with Cousins, we're not doing that. He had Isaiah Thomas and they like butted heads, but
he got a little bit better as time went on, but it just, he definitely was not someone who could be the hub of a beautiful basketball wheel.
The Twitter sphere went crazy last night when they ran that 5-4 pick and roll for one play. And to be honest with you, I kind of cracked up at the reaction to it because that wasn't even really a 5-4 pick and roll. Like that was like the softest 5-4 pick and roll. Davis came from the corner, kind of pretended to set the screen, and then went to the basket for an alley-oop. And it was pretty, but it's like kind of a 5-4 pick and roll. But the thing that's tantalizing about them is that they're both so skilled. Davis is actually not a very good passer, which is disappointing. That's the one area of his game. I don't know how you really work on it, but it's something I think he should work on. But you can run those actions. Like, why not put – look, Solomon Hill and Etuan Moore I don't think are that great of players. Like, they're very average role players. They're not that good. And more importantly, their best skills, in my opinion, are cutting and driving to the basket, which you need them to be standstill shooters if you're running a lot of these, like, heavy ISOs. I think that's why last night you look at it, I think both guys had 2 points. Like, nobody off the bench – nobody – other than the big three scored last night. And I think the thing I would do if I was coaching the team, and obviously this is like famous last words, this is like the peak of hyperbole here, but if I was coaching the team, I would try to open up the paint. It sounds weird because you have two guys that are dominant in the paint, but I would open up the paint early in the offense and bring those two guys up top. And the reason I would do that is because that opens up, that makes Moore and Solomon Hill useful in the first 5 seconds of the play, and when they're useful, that's when you could start to create mismatches, because then you have to actually guard those guys on cuts and on different things. And if you have to guard them for the first 5 seconds, even if it's just a setup, then you still get the switches you want to be able to post up Anthony Davis and or DeMarcus Cousins or what have you, or run those 5-4 pick and roll actions. So
here's where I think that falls apart, and I'm sorry to sort of cut you off, but I think that falls apart because I think NBA defenses will call that bluff and be right. I think that they'll just say, okay, we'll sort of vaguely respond to Solomon Hill cutting, and Solomon Hill is just not competent enough to, like, make them pay.
Here's the problem, though. Let's just say Drew Holiday, great scorer, right? Driver, you can run him off screens, and he can make a play. Now you've got Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins setting a high screen. This is what Dallas does, by the way. They almost always start with a double high screen just to kind of like get the defense moving. So you come up top with a double high screen. You're talking about calling a bluff. How do you call a bluff when Anthony Davis rolls to the rim off of two high screens? Because two high screens, you're going to have to hedge. There's just no... You can't not. When there's two of them up top, you have to hedge on it. So now you're starting a second behind, and Anthony Davis is rolling to the rim. How can you stop that? Because he's one of the best rollers to the rim. Now, let's say, and then DeMarcus Cousins pops. You have to guard him on the pop. You got one guy rolling who's elite. You got another guy popping who's really good at driving off of a scrambled defense. He can hit the three, or he can go right into a dribble handoff if you swing it. Or vice versa. Roll DeMarcus to the rim. He's huge. You have to put your biggest guy on him. Most teams don't have a power forward that can guard him, so that means the center can't hedge. He has to stick with him. And now you have Anthony Davis's guy who's in that predicament, and Anthony Davis is money from the free throw line. So
right, yeah.
The reason I bring that up is, yeah, you can call the bluff, but I think that the guys guarding Hill and Moore have to react to that action, or else you're giving a pretty good look to Drew Holiday, DeMarcus Cousins, or Anthony Davis. And by the way... This is the first 10 seconds of the offense. This is just the first action you run before you get into your offense.
I guess what I'm saying is that Etuan Moore and Solomon Hill's mans, like, they will respond and cheat off of those two guys, and sometimes just leave them completely wide open for a corner three, which is supposed to be one of the most efficient shots in the game, unless you're Etuan Moore or Solomon Hill.
Right.
I think it's like, yeah, I think you're totally right if you replace Etuan Moore with Ray Allen and Solomon Hill with Shane Battier. But
one of the other goals is that you want to create a switch, right? Because Davis and Cousins are both so good at scoring against undersized guys in the post.
Oh, yeah.
So part of it isn't even like, let's get him open in the corner. It's more about, let's get the switch to happen. Like, you know, if Davis is popping to the free throw line and the only guy within range is Etuan Moore's guy, chances are he's going to rotate over to be like, okay, we can't give Davis the free throw line jumper. So you could leave Moore open, but then you've already created a switch, and now Moore just comes up to the top of the key. Davis goes back to the opposite side block, and let's post him up now against the shooting guard. You know, like,
yeah.
So I think that's actually more of it. And you know what? My belief is, when guys are that wide open consistently, not just like once a game, but when they know that that's the shot coming, they're a little bit more mentally prepared, and maybe the numbers can rise a little bit.
That's the hope, right? Is that, like, maybe LeBron can make Mo Williams a superstar, but right. Anthony Davis and Boogie both being on the court at the same time can make Dante Cunningham like an all-star, you know?
I'm absolutely with you, though, about like those guys. That's why I wasn't high on them making the playoffs this year. And actually, I think they're going to struggle pretty mightily this year. and even said as much. But I think I do think going forward, you kind of build that style of play, and then you can build around it.
Omri Caspi going down is a big deal, I think, because even though I think that he's out of position, he can hit wide open shots, and you're not hoping on ideas like, well, he's going to be so open, you know? It would have been good to have a guy. And I think Etuan Moore is more competent than Solomon Hill, and that's and that's a real thing. Well,
I think in a vacuum, I like Hill better. I just not on this team. Like, his value is that, like, driving to the basket, which is just not needed anymore.
Yeah,
is it not needed? It's not there now that you have two bigs.
Right. He's a four, which is part of the reason why, like, he was only good on the Pacers as a four. So, yeah, man. Okay. Well, so we're just jumping around randomly. So, Serge Ibaka is a five.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, he's being. I think that, you know, people say, well, like, you know, he just doesn't have, like, the leap that he used to have. He's not able to cover the same amount of space. So he's just not as good as he used to be. And, like, to a certain extent, that's true. But I think he's a better shooter than like, weak side shot blocker Serge Ibaka, who plays the four. I think he's a better shooter, which makes him even more valuable as a center. And I still think he has the defensive instincts. He just can't cover the same, like, distance, basically.
If you look at the last 2 years, Valanciunas, the thing he's kind of struggled at is in playoff series, he's been taken off the court by undersized fives, right? Because he actually has a surprising hard time scoring against, like, undersized fives in a playoff series when they can double and kind of take away his isolation post game. So now I guess that makes him as a little bit of an insurance policy, although Bebe is also there, you know, kind of for that as well. But maybe he takes away that so that now – what series was it? Was it last year where Valanciunas got like 6 minutes and then he just couldn't play the rest of the game? I can't even remember what series it was.
It might have been against the Heat after Hassan Whiteside got injured.
Maybe. I actually can't remember off the top of my head. But I know there was one where it was like games he was playing like 5 to 10 minutes and that's all he could get. But,
yeah. I mean, like, every series basically.
And the Raptors, I think, are actually kind of versatile now with their front court because there are a handful of different looks you can throw at the 4-5 combo to make it look somewhat interesting.
Yeah, I think people take it too far and say, like, well, okay, now since you can play Patrick Patterson and Serge Ibaka, Valanciunas is useless. And I think that's definitely not true. I think I think that at times against like the Cavaliers, that you're going to want Valanciunas out there because he's going to be the best response to a guy like Tristan Thompson, probably.
Yeah, right.
But
and that's what it is. I think this team is – it wouldn't be surprised if they play one way one series and a different way the next series. And to me, that's kind of what both of their moves were. And I don't know how successful that can be. Like, teams take
I don't know
so
how successful it can be with Dwayne Casey.
Ooh, yeah, that's interesting.
I've been a big proponent of Casey, but I'm starting to think that he's sort of gotten to the place where, you remember earlier we were talking about one type of coach is good for a developing team.
Right. Like, yeah.
I don't think are a lot of coaches really, like, in the last 30, 40 years who could have made Kyle Lowry reach the heights that he's met, and also DeMar DeRozan, you know, who is a questionable decision making, whatever. I think that given the things that DeMar DeRozan does, he's being used really, really well. But the question is right now, like, how much further can he take them? And I think the answer might be no further.
Let me just play devil's advocate with you, because you might be right. I'm not even saying you are. In fact, I think I probably agree with you. But what if the bigger issue is DeMar DeRozan? And here's what I mean. The Cavs have played different styles in different series, you know, over the last couple of years, where they'll be like, you know, they'll play Channing Frye and Kevin Love together a ton against the Hawks and then not at all against the Warriors, right? So they can change it up. But the difference is your main guy, LeBron James, is the smartest guy on the court, and he can adjust possession by possession, let alone series by series. But DeMar DeRozan's a little bit more of a guy that does what he does really, really, really well, but not necessarily a guy that can do a bunch of different things or play a bunch of different styles. So maybe – obviously some of it I think will be coaching, but maybe some of it is just the, like, inability of DeRozan to adapt series by series.
Yeah, well, and I think that's accurate, but as we've seen a lot, it's easier to replace a coach than a superstar player. You know,
that's true. Yeah.
I think that poses a difficulty that Coach Casey, I'm sorry that Coach Casey has to deal with that. It's a real thing. I agree that is problematic, but maybe someone else could deal with it, you know?
Maybe.
And it's interesting because, it's just not one of those things that I'm confident about, especially confident about to call for, someone's job. I'm definitely not, Dwayne Casey witch hunting here. I don't know if that's a correct instinct, and he's a good dude, and until you know that that's the problem, you shouldn't fire him. But it is an interesting question because I think that we are going to, I think that in all likelihood by the end of this playoffs, when the Raptors get knocked out, I think there's going to be multiple crucial junctions where NBA Twitter and NBA intelligentsia is going to ask, why wasn't Serge Ibaka and Patrick Patterson playing? Why wasn't it Serge Ibaka, Patrick Patterson, Kyle Lowry, and, probably whoever at the 2 and 3, maybe not DeMar DeRozan, right? Maybe the answer is to take him off the court. And I think that if that happens this year and they lose because of mistakes that he made, which I think almost happened last year, against the Pacers with Luis Scola, and it happens again next year, then I might be saying, okay, we should probably replace Dwayne Casey, because at that point they'll be locked into 4 more years of Lowry and 4 more years of Ibaka, and the only other way that you could go is replacing the coach. They'll just be locked into there's no other way to improve.
I think you're right. But for me, if it was me personally, I'd probably go the other way and try to replace DeRozan, I think. But it is interesting. PJ Tucker's a good player. I like PJ Tucker. He's such a good defender. Being on the Suns, I think, makes you, it's kind of like being on the Nuggets, where people just don't get to see enough of a guy, right? So I think PJ Tucker's actually a pretty good player. I'm very curious to see how that shakes out and what kind of minutes he's getting, and where he's getting those minutes.
Yeah. I think that he'll probably, he's probably maybe best used as a sort of stretch four response, but is probably going to be most useful as a LeBron response at the three, right?
Right. Yeah, I think you're right about that. That'll be an interesting matchup. I wonder what LeBron's done against the Suns and against him. If he's, he hasn't really had to be good against the Suns, but I wonder if PJ Tucker has been like this sneaky good defender against him.
Yeah.
I don't know.
If that's true, then Masai Ujiri knows. That guy, yeah. I was on our Slack on the network Slack, and I described him as a managerial ballerina. and then I was like, accurate. Oh, Masai Ujiri's the black swan.
Oh, geez.
I thought that was pretty clever. But yeah, no, I mean, I bet Ujiri knows that. He's a genius. I mean, I think he's been so, so deft, so delicate, such a perfect touch with these moves.
I still don't, the short answer to all of this is I still don't really believe in Toronto, but we'll see.
Yeah, me neither. But don't you believe, I maybe believe in them more than I did last year. I thought they were going to get knocked down in the first round by the Pacers.
The funny thing is they went to 6 games last year, and I think we talked about this last time on the pod. I'm still convinced that LeBron threw those 2 games. I think that was I know we can beat this team so easily, so I'm going to teach my team a lesson or something. So I think the temptation is to say, man, they were within 2 games of beating the Cavs last year. I don't know if they were.
Yeah, well, but I think that they're a really, really different roster now.
Yeah, they are. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
I mean,
even Bebe's emergence, is makes them a bit different.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, Bebe might even be a good guy to play against Tristan Thompson. I mean, Thompson's
no question about it.
Thompson's not going to pull some wily stuff on Bebe. He's not Bebe's less wily, but Tristan Thompson is not so wily that you're concerned about it.
He's not Valanciunas.
Yeah, right. Well, so he's not gonna, I think, be in situations where last year Al Jefferson sort of dominating Whiteside in a weird way, you know?
Right.
Like I don't think that, well, but oh man, I don't know. We'll see when it comes around to the playoffs. But so other big deadline moves. Well, so before we started talking, I did mention that I wanted to touch on the fact that the Boston Celtics still like didn't make their big move, like deadline or otherwise. And I have really mixed feelings about it, but I think I have one way that I lean more than the other. What do you think?
I am probably in favor of it. And the reason
in favor of not making a move?
Correct. And as
yeah,
much as
that's like, where I'm
like,
leaning.
At the time, I'm like so excited. You know, everybody wants a trade, especially I have no relation to Boston, so I don't care if they win or lose. But at the time, you just want something to happen because it's more interesting. But the truth is, those Nets picks are so valuable. They really have an opportunity to be good now and rebuild, which is the best position you could be in. And the you know, there's a good chance they're going to land like Markelle Fultz here in a couple months, and maybe even another top pick in a couple years. So to me, I think that they probably did the right thing rather than trading everything for Jimmy Butler, who I think is really, really good, but wouldn't make them a contender. In my mind, I don't think it would make them a contender. So I think they did the right thing. It means they're probably not going to win a championship in the next 3 or 4 years, but it's probably the right move just because they are going to set themselves up to be a powerhouse in the 2020s, and maybe even a powerhouse a little bit before that, you know, depending on how things break. But they certainly
depending on like if the two generations convene at the right times.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. And what moves they can make. Maybe they can make a short term move while guys like, and I'm just going to assume Fultz is there, even though obviously that's not a certainty at all. But like while guys like that are developing, they still might be able to make this like short 2 year window where they do bring in like a Paul George or something, and are even better than they are now.
So, just as like a side note before we move on, I'm a little higher than consensus on Fultz, like because I watch Fultz and I see a lot of the same things.
High there,
well, okay, but here's the thing, right? I see a lot of the same things out of Fultz that I saw out of LeBron in high school and out of Steph on Davidson. He went to Davidson, right? Yeah. Whatever crappy school Steph went to. Where I just think that he would be so much better on a good team, and the reason for that is because he makes his teammates so much better, but it just doesn't matter because they all suck. And so like I see Fultz as if you put like a similarly thinking brain to LeBron's in like a just not like the reason why he's not LeBron James is because like he's just like not the athletic like dynamo, you know, like not the same. But I think Markelle Fultz is going to be like, I know everyone has him pegged for the number one pick, but I keep hearing and I keep reading, well, you never know how good like a guy's going to be coming out of the draft. It's like, I think Fultz is a little bit different. Like, That's how I feel. I mean, it's like I'm like fairly certain that Ben Simmons, for example, is going to be a superstar, but there are like real questions holding him back, and I feel like those don't really exist for Fultz. If you ask
Fultz's
me,
Fultz's floor is super high, and his ceiling is also super high. So like, yeah, I think you're right. I think he's the clear number one. I love Lonzo Ball's my guy. He's my dude. I just love.
Yeah, but like, don't you wonder if he like? Yes. I mean, he might not be amazing. I think he will be, but
100. No, no. I would say the risk is relatively high on Ball, especially given the father stuff. Like, if we just look at the basketball stuff, I think there's this risk of him, you know, not being as good at the NBA level because of the shot. You know, namely, I actually think his defense is okay. He gets killed for his defense, and he'll probably get killed in the NBA. But when guys understand rotations and stuff, that's just so important because I feel like guys can improve as on-ball defenders, and not everybody can like figure out the complexity of when to rotate and stuff. I think he has good instincts on that end. But yeah, the shot is concerning. The fact that he can't really dribble around a screen and pull up is concerning, although he had one last night. But he's so fun to watch. I just like watching him. But I'm with you on Fultz. Fultz is a different type of player. I think Ball's ceiling is high and his floor is low. Whereas Fultz's floor is high and his ceiling is probably even higher.
So the reason I started this conversation is because we're going to draw it back to the Celtics. if the Celtics were to get the number one pick, I would be in favor of trading Isaiah Thomas. If they got the number two pick, I would not. And in fact, either way, I wouldn't. But if I picked Markelle Fultz and I was the Celtics, I would be grooming him to be, you know, I wouldn't be expecting to extend Isaiah Thomas. I would maybe want to move him and have everyone be stunned or something like that.
There's probably – here's the funny thing about Isaiah Thomas is I wonder what his value is around the league, because he is such an interesting – like, he scores like crazy, right? My takes on Isaiah Thomas are probably hotter than the average, like,
Well, I think that when you really think about Isaiah Thomas, the structure of his contract that's coming soon, you know, like we were talking about Matt Moore at the introduction to this podcast, but he had a take the other day, and he was like, well, so after the Isaiah Thomas extension, or if you give Isaiah Thomas like that supermax or whatever, he'll be making $40 million when he's 33, and like that's not a hot take. That's like a statistic. Like that's fact. Yeah. And like, what do you do with that? Like, I think that there are issues with the Isaiah Thomas thing. And here's a big thing. And I had this conversation with James Hollis, and it freaked him out because he's hosting our Celtics podcast. I think I've scared him a little bit off of Isaiah Thomas. I think that the reason why this year, like last year, the Celtics defense was really good, right? Like that's great. Yeah. Awesome. And he was the starting point guard there. And that's a reason why. People say, well, you can have an elite defense starting Isaiah Thomas. But the thing is, I think last year in the finals, when LeBron won the finals, what you see is the teams mimic like the coaching and the roster and the structure and the ways that the champion does stuff, the way that the champion wins, everyone mimics that. So I think this year, that plan of, okay, we're going to put Steph into every pick and roll, we're going to hit him off of every corner, we're going to get him isolated onto our best player for every offensive possession, I think that people this year are doing that to Isaiah Thomas instead of moving around the ball and trying to do all this creative Golden State Warrior stuff that they were trying to do the year before last when the Warriors won the championship. So I think that, like, the Isaiah Thomas thing, him having literally the worst defensive box score plus minus in the league out of all 450 players, like the worst, I think that's a real thing. And I think
who can he guard?
What?
Like, who can he guard? What's a player that he can guard because he's so little? I mean, it's not like lack of trying or, you know, particularly bad instincts. He's just so little.
Yeah.
And that size, by the way, helps him on the offensive end. Like, he's a guy that really knows how to use his size to his advantage because – and this is coming from a fellow big guy. Like I little guys get the calls against bigger guys because you only have to have a little tiny bit of contact against the little guy and he goes flying. Whereas the opposite is true. Right, on offense, he can like run into a guy and push off, and it still doesn't look like a foul because he's so little. So it helps him on that end. But on the defensive end, there's nothing he could do. He jumps to contest Patrick Beverley's shot and doesn't get close. Like he can't even jump to contest to get the hand in the face to like block the vision. I mean, that's how little he is. So. But here's the other thing I would say about it, and I wonder if GMs feel the same way about Isaiah Thomas around the league, is that he's a tremendous scorer, this awesome player. Brad Stevens' best skill, in my opinion, is knowing what his players are good at and putting them in possession to exploit that. Like, how do these five guys work? What is it? What are their skill sets? What's good about them, and how does that work?
And so he's Rick Carlisle.
Yeah, well, except for Carlisle's more of a system guy, I think. I think Carlisle's more of like, give me the types of guys that work with what I do, and I'm going to really make this work. Well, I think Brad Stevens.
Whatever. Okay, so continue. Sorry, I'm from Dallas, least, forever, so I want to get into a fight about it. But
at least continue. More so than Stevens. I mean, they've always run this like, yeah. Never mind. Yeah,
if you
gave
prime Dirk Nowitzki to Brad Stevens, I think that you'd see a system around that. You know, like I think that Dirk's the system, and Rick Carlisle just responds by putting Dirk in the position best to.
You might be right. Guys get the knock of being a system coach when they coach a guy, you know, like that for so long, I guess. So that makes sense. But
thank you for conceding that I'm right. Oh, and Robert Covington too. I appreciate that.
Right. That was a good one. I'm using it, stealing it. But so I think I wonder with Thomas, like if you put him on the Nuggets, for example, would he be like, this is MVP candidate player? You know, would they be running some different types of actions that maybe don't exploit him? And so that's what I think with him. But yeah, I'm all in on the idea of keep the picks. They're set up. I would, I love Jokic, so maybe I wouldn't really do this, but I would probably swap just prospects with Boston just because the fact that they are going to have two number one picks in 3 years on top of already having Jaylen Brown.
Yeah, and I'm not like a guy who has any idea who the high school prospects are. And right. So like I don't know, you know, what people are going to say about the draft after this next draft, like about the 2018 draft, you know,
could possibly have an actual read on that. I mean,
Sam Vecenie.
Yeah. Except for even then you're wrong. Cause you're talking about a guy that can't even drive yet. Like he can't drive a car. And we're talking about how well he's going to handle the NBA. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, even in college, it's like,
College, it's tough. But if we're talking about 16-year-olds, I mean, Anthony Davis was like 6'3" at this point. You know, like who really knows what the draft is going to look like?
Yeah. Man, how was Michael Beasley not good? Okay. All right. Well, so I think that while what you just said is true, that offensively you couldn't optimize him without a top like five coach in the league, which is interesting because you use Mike Malone as an example, but you know, moving on from that. But I think defensively is the real issue with Isaiah Thomas and where I was going with that, where I was saying like offenses, I think are taking advantage in one-on-one type stuff of players like Isaiah Thomas better than they did the year before, when it was more about like, you know, trying to go small and trying to shoot threes and trying to be like the Warriors. Now it's like trying to be like the Cavs, and they take it at Isaiah Thomas every possession, and even more so than some of the guys on the Nuggets that we've talked about, actually, like Moutier dying on screens a lot. Isaiah Thomas, like there's no question about effort. It's like a reality that like he's gonna die if you put if you put Bogut in front of him, and I think that you're right that you take the picks and you develop those players and you try to win a championship in 5 years, because as long as you have Isaiah Thomas at point guard and as long as you have Al Horford, who has like similar glaring holes when he's playing the center and might have different holes at the four. So it's sort of like, well, you can be a 55 win team and you can be that for a while, but you probably can't be any better when those are two of your top three best players.
The Celtics are going to win a title this year. And then James is going to like add us about it every single day. That's how this will play out.
Well, man, we need to do this more often. It's
always fun, man.
Yeah. Well, one more time for the folks at home. You should let them know. Oh, and I pulled up your article on NBA.com/stats. It's DeMarcus Cousins and Anthony Davis make for a formidable front court duo.
Yeah, I don't write the headlines though, just so.
Okay. Well, so that's by Adam Mores, and then Nylon Calculus brought to you by The Step Back. So go read that. I'm going to.
And then the one on Vice as well. If you're not sick of my takes on Vice too? Yeah, the Nylon or the NBA.com one is like a bunch of interesting stats about them. And then the one on Vice is like some video breakdown on stuff that, in my opinion, they should be doing, which we talked about a little bit on this podcast, but there's like videos and stuff to kind of back up why I think it'll work. But
So you do think it'll work? Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to talk about that next time.
I don't think it'll work. I think there's certain type of actions that would work.
It could work?
Yeah, exactly. Like this is what they could do that would make them very, very unique. But I don't think they can do those things. Like, I don't think Cousins can step his role, you know, cut his role in like significantly. I just don't think he can. I don't think it's in him. But that's kind of the angle of the article, is if they did these things, I think it would get the most out of the pairing.
Do you want to like record in a week and just talk about the Pelicans? Because like I haven't had that podcast yet.
They might be like 0-5 at that point. I mean, honestly, like this team. The pairing is not a natural pairing. I'm not ruling out them being really bad. You know, like I would say the odds of them being really bad this year, not next. You get a training camp in a summer and some moves, like you can start to piece things together better. But this year on the fly, I'm not ruling out them being. I think the chances of them being really bad are as good as them being like actually legitimately good.
I think they're better. I think that there's probably a higher chance of them being bad than them being good.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think that, you know, a lot of things can change over the summer. Follow at Adam_Marez, site manager of the Denver Stiffs, or at the Denver Stiffs, and Vice Sports. Read his article. I just looked it up. How Boogie and the Brow will fit in with the Pelicans, the NBA wraparound. So that's by Adam Marez of Vice. DeMarcus Cousins and Anthony Davis make a formidable front court duo. I haven't done the Pelicans breakdown podcast yet. And if you think that's interesting, I need to do it.
I love talking about big men because that's like my corner, right? That was what I played in college and in high school. So I like thinking about big men and versatile big men.
How tall are you?
I'm 6'5", 6'6", somewhere in between there.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I'm 6'4", so you're taller than I am.
The blogger sphere is pretty short. It's surprisingly short. So there's
rise above the rest, Adam.
Oh, gosh. Oh, please edit that out. I was going to plug one more thing, though.
Oh, please.
This is actually my best thing to plug. We have these dope Magic Jokic t-shirts on DenverStiffs.com. So if you are a Jokic fan, go and get one. And if you're not, you need to become one. So hop on Denver Stiffs right below the fold. There's these cool Magic Jokic shirts, and they're $24. And they're actually pretty high-quality shirts. I was surprised.
Yeah, I'm looking at them right now. It's BreakingT.com, new from Denver Stiff, t-shirts on sale featuring Magic Jokic. Yeah, go check them out. You can also go check out, listeners, if you are anti-Jokic, which I'm not sure why you would be, you can check out, we have t-shirts on almightyballer.com. You can also find the rest of our shows at blogtalkradio.com/ABPN. All right, thanks, Adam. I'll let you go. Great talking to you, as always.
Thanks so much, brother.